nobody quite knew whether we were going to start to move today or tomorrow or the next day. And then all of it, we were shown a mock-up of the land where we were going to land. No names, nothing. I mean, you got a hill here and a bay here, but it was all part of the French coast.
Yeah.
But you didn't know which
sections.
It was.
Hmm? They just showed you small sections?
Well, the section that you knew that you were going to land in, so you knew. Right, but you didn't know whether it was down by Spain or, you know, up.
Did you know
further?
That it would be France for sure? You knew that?
Some of us did. Some of us knew exactly where we were going. You can't keep anything absolutely quiet. And there's always somebody who's been told, you know, not to tell anybody anything, but they just have to. So yeah, I was one of the ones, and there were quite a few who, from the company commanders too, and knew quite a lot about where we were going. So eventually we went down to Port Southampton by trucks and loaded aboard a ship. In our case, it was a Queen Emma. There were several carrying the Scottish, and eventually we moved out into what they call the Solent, which is the body of water between the mainland of England and the Isle of Wight. And we anchored out there, there for several days. Each day it was, you know, maybe it's going to be tomorrow. And as you probably heard, the weather was terrible. And General Eisenhower had to decide whether it'll be tomorrow or not, and decided from all the forecasts that it was go. And there was no turning back, because they had to start ships moving from way up in northern England, and once you got it going, you couldn't stop any part of it. Mm-hmm. And one thing most of the day, we all had shovels, short handles and shovels, to dig slit trenches. But most of us went down in the engine room and sharpened them all up, so they were razor sharp. So they became a better weapon if you got into hand-to-hand fighting than a rifle was. Mm. And
what was the mood of the men aboard ship?
Oh, everybody was, you know, it's a matter of, it's too late to anything about it now. Most of us wrote letters home saying, you know, you may get this, you may not. But my daughter still is the one that I wrote to my mother and dad, and I wrote one to my wife. And that was, you know, it was pretty universal. And then we knew that it was going to be the next day. And it was a bit unnerving to see the crew laying out first aid kits right and left and center, and fire hoses and that sort of thing. And I was shared with the medical officer a tiny cabin way down below the watermark. And we sort of deliberated, you know, if we go down there and we get hit by a torpedo, it's curtains. If we stay up here, we got some chance. But on the other hand, we need a good sleep, because tomorrow's going to be tough. So we said, the hell with it, we go down, have a good sleep. Got up in the morning, oh, 4:30, I guess it was, and got up on the deck and looked out, and as far as you could see, it was a sea of ships. You know, you never explain what it looked like. Yeah? Large ships, small ships, and everything. So, you know, we left about 11 o'clock at night from where we'd been at anchor. And I guess it was about 10 miles out, and it was rough as hell that we were to be dropped. So, you know, we had a good meal, a good breakfast, climb into the landing craft. And the padre was up on the bridge, he said a prayer over the PA system, and then lower away. Brother, was it rough. And I mean, it's just like dropping big lifeboats on ships, you know, and there's about 38 men in each one. None of ours overturned, but some did from some of the other ships, Of course, everybody's got Mae West on, so you've got a chance. And,
Are you still a lieutenant at this time?
No, captain. Adjutant, yeah. Been for quite some time there now. And there's about 38 of us in the landing craft, and we're heading in, tossed around like crazy. The only one I saw actually being seasick was the naval officer who was commanding the thing. He was rather forward. All of us had taken, well, we'll call them seasick pills. I don't know what the hell they were. And I don't know if you've ever seen a landing craft or been in one that you can get down sort of under a cowling. And I stood up most of the time. Sooner be shot than land up there seasick and not be able to do anything. So we got in, well, I don't know, I guess we were about 5 miles out. We had a naval ship, a small motor torpedo boat, sort of guiding us in. Whatnot. And we got so far in, and they just called out and said, well, goodbye, you're on your own. Best of luck, sir, right? Yeah. Meanwhile, all hell's breaking loose. There, you know. Parachutes and planes and ships shelling and everything going back and forth. Crazy. So we got in, as I say, we weren't able to get in properly, so we managed to come up alongside a larger landing craft, a motor landing for carrying trucks and that sort of thing. And so we clambered onto it and jumped off the end. So we were in water up to about here, trying to keep a rifle dry and all the rest of your stuff. So we got in on the beach. And there was a sort of bank up ahead of us, and we all sort of, got together, got organized a bit. I was with battalion headquarters, and the colonel was up front there, and it was up to me to keep battalion headquarters sort of organized. So the colonel sort of got up far enough and figured we had to do something instead of staying there. And so. And he sort of yelled out, you know, battalion headquarters, come on, and see, so I turn around. Battalion headquarters, you know, come on, and sort of said, who, me? They got up over top of this bank, and it's big grain fields ahead of us. And all along there are signs that say, what's the word, German word, that means watch out for mines, I think. You didn't know whether they were mines or not. I mean, they put them up just to, you know, scare the daylight out of you. And so we start going through this grain, crawling in it, huh? And one of the chaps, I call him Squire Whiteman, Colonel Whiteman, have you met him?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's head of the cancer, cancer society, shall we say, Victoria. He's older than I am. He's about 82, and a real card. He was a little bit ahead there, and there was bullets coming right, left, and center. And I remember him saying, every time I stand up, they shoot at me. He said, look, and he stood up, and zing, zing, zing. Then he crawled through this field, got up there, and got up to sort of consolidate a bit, and there were a lot of our fellows lying, you know, dead as we passed them, and so you couldn't do anything for them. The stretcher bearers were coming, they could do more for them than we had. We had to keep going. And planes overhead like crazy, and the thing is that the enemy soon realized what the markings were on our planes, and they had our markings on their planes in probably no time, so you couldn't tell who was who. Well, it's pretty hard to tell what happened that day. We gained certain areas that we were supposed to, didn't get as far in other areas as we were supposed to. That night, Colonel wanted me to make a recce further forward. We took a carrier. I was with him, one other fellow, and a Brent Gunner and Wichita thought we knew where we were going, and then suddenly realized we were already behind the enemy lines and turned back. He had to get to brigade headquarters. Well, we got there. It's impossible to remember, you know, from day to day.
Oh, yeah. Well,
what happened. We
talk about the things you remember best, the instances.
And we got into a farmhouse where we sort of made our headquarters for a little while. We had to pull back because there was one big field where we advanced. I won't say we because I was at the back of them, and all kinds of fellows got killed. And Jerry was just shelling that area, and there were a lot of cows there, and they were getting killed too. And it was hot as hell. And over the next few days, we tried to get our fellows that were dead and pull back. And Padre, you haven't met him, and of course he's down east. Just had a letter from him the other day. And he was busy burying the dead. And eventually we traded place with the Regiment de Chaudière, French Canadian. And they were there and we were here, and we were supposed to trade. Well, when you trade a thing like that, you do it, you know, in small doses and whatnot. But they just up and left. And we had to rush in there and take over their place bit by bit. And then 26th of June, this was, we had our headquarters in a old farmhouse, and about 9 o'clock at night, Jerry started shelling. He sent one shell over top of us, the next one behind us, so we knew he was ranging, and it was just a matter of minutes before he was going to get dead on. And we had rigged up a system of blackouts. It was all blankets and all that sort of stuff over the windows. At this time, they were sort of rolled up. And the intelligence officer and the signals officer and I were sort of in the middle of the room looking at maps and that sort of stuff. And when this started, I jumped over to the window, yanked the string that was holding up, and the blankets, whatnot, came down, and a shell came right in there again. Next thing I remember was that I was being dragged into a slip trench outside. The other two guys were killed, so if I hadn't jumped over to that window, I wouldn't have been here now. And so that's how close you can come, whatnot. So I came to in the slip trench. somebody dragged me into it. Eventually somebody pulled me out, put on a Jeep ambulance, and we started down toward the beach. That meant going to an advanced dressing station. I got hit on the head mainly. And there they sort of cut all my hair off and put a big, like a pad of Kotex on the top of it, and then go down to another station further down. And then they'd take that off and put more gunk on and whatnot. Eventually, during the night, landed up down at the beach. We were in big marquees and whatnot. Everybody lying around there. And, you know, morning came, and then we were transferred by stretcher and ambulance again right onto the beach and put in more landing craft to go out to hospital ship. And it was so bloody rough on the landing craft. Every time it came down like that, my head just about blew off. Got out to the hospital ship. It was so rough, we were the last craft out. So she lay there all night because they didn't move at night. They're supposed to move when, you know, they can be seen, so the enemy knows it's a hospital ship because they're not supposed to, you know, bomb hospital ships. So we know of one that was sunk. So back to England, back to Southampton, onto a hospital train, and up to a military hospital called Wokingham. And from there, I guess I was there about a week and then sent to another hospital in another part of southern England. I don't even remember where it was. And eventually there to a place up in Colchester and a rehab sort of hospital, and then from there up to a depot in the middle of England, whatnot, where outfitted all over again, and then eventually back down and over to France again. Caught up to the unit and went back in as adjutant for a while.
Whereabouts had you caught up to them? Past Caen?
Yeah. That had been taken past Caen, yeah. Sounds good enough. Yeah. And not too long as the Cabledew, who was our OC, Colonel Cabledew, had been taken over 4th Brigade. He was a brigadier then. And he knew I was interested in staff work, so he sent for me. So I went to 4th Brigade headquarters, where I stayed till war ended. I was what they call staff learner, staff captain, assistant to the deputy assistant adjutant and quartermaster general at the brigade level, who was a major. And there, of course, you're in charge of certain aspects of the whole brigade, all the different battalions, and there's a lot of liaison work and so on. Well, there are a lot of pretty hairy trips, and then the end of the war in Europe came, and all sort of waiting to go home. When I came down with the infectious hepatitis, which is jaundice, a lot of the fellows did, and they figured it was from, you know, bad water or something like that. So eventually I went to a Canadian hospital in Oldenburg, and then moved from there, the whole hospital moved to Wilmshaven, which is up in the northern part of Germany and whatnot. And was there and went back to brigade headquarters, and then was posted to a draft to come home, so that meant over to Aldershot. Well, I did go on a course while the war was still on, when I was at brigade, with the idea that I would join the force that was going to stay over in Germany. And I was supposed to learn German.
Oh.
It was about 2 weeks course. You're supposed to learn to speak German from scratch. Bloody big book like that. I never learned any German that was worth a damn, and had a good time on the course anyway. And eventually went to Aldershot, came home, came across Canada. It was about October, see, 44, you know, about October 45, I guess. And then came right back to Victoria, and had about a month's leave, went back to Little Mountain in Vancouver for a discharge routine. Just got over there and they said, oh, they want you to stay in for a while because our 3rd Battalion was acting as a sort of occupational force, and I was to help plan its return. And I don't know if you ever heard of Colonel Urquhart. He was honorary colonel of the regiment way back, and he was writing the history of Sir Arthur Currie.
Yeah.
So I worked with him, helping him with a lot of that sort of stuff and planning the return of the regiment. There was all sorts of, you know, organizational work and whatnot. And I guess I got out about June of this and that next year, 46. I'd been in for 7 years by that time.
You left as a major?
No, captain. Never became a major. They've got me down as a major.
Yeah, that's
now.
Right. Okay.
I think there's some routine where they figure if you were one rank, they sort of put you up a rank on paper and whatnot. But I don't know. But they've had. I've told everybody I'm not a major, but mail still comes that way.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, or any topic that we haven't discussed that you'd like to say a few words about?
I haven't remained active with the militia at all. They started having battle officers dinners around the 6th of June and that sort of stuff. I went to a few. And, well, if you're going to be active in that sort of thing, you've got to be prepared to spend money, and I didn't have any. I went back to a BC government job. When the war broke out, I was making $90 a month, and when I went back to it, it was $150 a month now. That was bloody little to get by on. I had one, was married, one child, and so I had no money to throw around on that sort of thing. If you belong to an organization like that, you got to be prepared to do a certain amount of entertaining and drinking and whatnot. Couldn't afford it, so. Now and again, I'll be in touch with them. They're very good friends with the Padre, whom I mentioned. He retired as Archbishop of Labrador in Eastern Newfoundland. Visited him a couple of occasions when I've been east. He comes out here every now and again. And I guess, have you met Charlie McNeil?
His name's on the list. I think he might have already been interviewed, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I really can't think of anything that makes any sense. Half the stuff I've said doesn't make any sense to anybody who wasn't there and don't know what I'm talking about. If it's of value to anybody, they can have it.
Sure it will be.